Welcome to another Fanhouse MMA podcast. I'm Michael David Smith, and I'm joined, as always, by Ariel Helwani after a big weekend in the MMA world. Ariel, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Another, I think probably one of the most fun weekends of the year in MMA, so very much looking forward to talking to you about it.
Yeah, and we had a great weekend to reflect on. We'll also talk about UFC 99 coming up this weekend, but let's start in chronological order with Saturday Night Strikeforce. You know, I thought that it was a pretty good show overall. Certainly some surprises. I would say that, you know, Brett Rogers and Jake Shields, both surprising, especially how quickly they won. What do you take away from that Strikeforce show, and how do you assess how well it went for Strikeforce?
Well, I thought it went really well, and I think the biggest thing about it that I take away was, you know, both of us were, you know, fairly negative about this show. Some of the, you know, the booking plans that we thought this was going to lead into, and just some of the matchups I thought were a little bit strange, and we were quite vocal about that. But I think if you know, Scott Coker and company would have laid out the perfect plan as to how everything would, you know, would shake out Sunday morning, this is exactly what happened, except for Kevin Randleman losing. That was probably a negative for them because he's a lot more marketable than Mike Whitehead. But when you have Jake Shields winning, when you have Nick Diaz, winning, and of course Brett Rogers winning, that's huge for Strikeforce because those are, you know, those are three really big stars that they have on the roster. And I think Shields and Rogers in particular, because those are two guys, and one of the only two guys that they have on their roster that aren't UFC castoffs, and those are guys that they could say, you know, these are, you know, quasi homegrown talent that that could beat any of the UFC guys. You know, like Jake Shields always talks about beating GSP and all that, and I think that makes them look good that they're not just a bunch of UFC castoffs like the Robbie Lawlers and the Diazes and the Babalus of the world. So I think everything worked out perfectly, and obviously the big thing is Brett Rogers beating Andre Arlovski, because Andre Arlovski was just coming in for one fight. Who knows if they could have gotten him to fight Alistair Overeem, but here you have Rogers come in and in vicious fashion knocking out Andre Arlovski like that. That's pretty shocking. So all in all, a very positive show. And really, now I'm really excited for what Strikeforce has next, to see what they do with these guys. And on June 19th, they have another great show. So my tune has changed very quickly on the future of Strikeforce.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you. I think you make a very good point about Jake Shields and Brett Rogers not being UFC castoffs, which I think is important. Jake Shields, certainly a top 10 welterweight. Brett Rogers, in my opinion, just sneaked into the top 10 heavyweights. Some may think he's not quite
there. Really? You really have him top
there.
10 already?
I do have him top 10 already. You need to read Fanhouse because I already posted my top 10 heavyweights, and Brett Rogers is number 10. I think he deserves it. I think Brett Rogers deserves to be considered a top 10 heavyweight. I'm just number 10, and I can certainly understand why some people would say that's way premature. But I do. I think he's that impressive. I still have some questions about what they do next with these guys, though. Will they get the Brett Rogers versus Alistair Overeem heavyweight title fight? That's certainly what everyone would love to see, but I don't know that's necessarily going to happen, because we've heard before that Alistair Overeem is coming to defend his heavyweight belt, and he hasn't done it yet. And then Jake Shields, I still have a big question of who he fights next and at which weight class, because, you know, this was at a catchweight fight, but closer to middleweight. I still think of him as a welterweight. I think, he's probably a top five welterweight in the world, but all the other good welterweights are in the UFC, so it's a little bit difficult to figure where he's going to go next. A fight that would make a lot of sense is Jake Shields versus Nick Diaz. I suppose a skeptic could say that would be for the catchweight championship belt, but the problem there is that those two guys are buddies and training partners. I don't think they'd fight each other. I don't think the middleweight champion Kung Lee is going to fight either one of those guys. So I still feel like Strikeforce, although I don't want to diminish what they did Saturday night because they put on a good show, I still feel like they have questions remaining about what they're going to do with these guys who won these big fights.
Well, first of all, sorry for not checking out the site. I was kind of flying across the country yesterday, so had some other things, you know. But I apologize. Thank you. I appreciate it. But I think that there are clear, it's pretty much a clear-cut path for Brett Rogers. He might not fight in August, which, you know, I wouldn't blame them. They did announce Alistair Overeem going to be on the show, but, you know, that's happened before where they announce a guy like Babalu, and then, like, 3 days later, we find out that, you know, his wife is having a child and he's not fighting. He is clearly the number one contender just because they have no other contenders, and a lot of people are excited about him, and it's not a crazy thought to put him as the number one contender. I don't know if he'll be ready to fight in 2 months. I mean, he didn't have to do too much on Saturday night, so I don't see why not. As for Jake Shields, you're right. It needs to be Nick Diaz, but it's not going to happen. You saw just, you know, how close they are after the Shields fight. They were hugging in the cage, and they're definitely good friends. They live, in the same portion of the country up in Northern California. That's a problem. Jake Shields, I heard him say...
August show is taking place, by the way, so it would be wonderful to see those guys on that show, but they certainly won't be fighting each other. They might not even be on it at all.
Right. Jake Shields brought up a great potential matchup against a guy by the name of Jason Mayhem Miller, who's a guy who I think that Strikeforce should definitely try to sign because he has now mainstream appeal. He's a UFC veteran, but he's a guy that a lot of fans love, very loyal fan base. Very charismatic. I mean, he's a great addition to their lineup, and I think that would be a great fight. Great styles that complement each other, and I could see that being for maybe the vacant welterweight title. It all depends really on whether Jake Shields wants to move back now to 170 or if he wants to stick around at the 185 region. I think it would be better for him.
Wait a minute. Do you think Mayhem Miller can make 170? I'm not so sure that he can.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if he wants to stick around at 185, then maybe it is Mayhem Miller. The thing is, it really all depends on Jake Shields because he's often talked about wanting to move up, but I think he's talked about wanting to move up because he feels like there's no real competition for him in Elite XC then or Strikeforce now. So if it's a 185 title, then I guess it would be Mayhem Miller. If it's 170, again, like you said, I don't know. A big loser in all this is really Robbie Lawler because he was doing so well in Elite XC, one of the stars that they helped rebuild. And when you lose to a guy who's usually fights at a weight class 15 pounds under yours and the fashion in which he lost, it's pretty bad. So I'm curious to see what they do with him next. It would be great to see him fight Kung Lee, but I don't think that's happening. I really think at this point, this is the end of Kung Lee's MMA career. I can't see him coming back anytime soon.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also agree, Robbie Lawler, tough to say, you know, would he have a rematch with Nick Diaz? The two of them had a really fun fight at UFC 74. Would they say, okay, 5 years later, let's put those two back in the cage together? I think that could be interesting. He also is a guy who could have a rematch with Mayhem Miller as well, as long as we're talking about Mayhem Miller, who's not even under contract to Strikeforce. So Robbie Lawler, there are other good fights that you could put him into. But I think you're right that it is disappointing that he really did not look good at all. You know, I've heard Gus Johnson on the broadcast, and I've heard some people afterwards say that, you know, at first Robbie Lawler was looking good in the stand-up. I didn't think he was looking very good in the stand-up either, but then he especially wasn't looking good when he just kind of ducked his head right into Jake Shields, did exactly what Jake Shields wanted him to do. I thought Robbie Lawler looked pretty bad. You might be able to make the case, not to take anything away from Jake Shields, but that it was more Robbie Lawler looking bad than Jake Shields looking good.
Well, in the stand-up department, yes. I don't think Jake Shields' stand-up looked all that good. But I don't know. That guillotine submission is pretty damn impressive for a strong guy, a stronger guy too, like Robbie Lawler. So I think Jake Shields looked pretty good. And a lot of people thought that Robbie Lawler was going to pick him apart on his feet. And you could say that Robbie Lawler didn't look that good. But on the flip side, Jake Shields hung in there. And I thought that was amazing performance, and the first time, you know, I've heard people not call Jake Shields even a top five welterweight, and you could say that he hasn't had a chance to fight, you know, top tier talent. This was top tier talent. This is a guy who is considered a top five middleweight, and he picked him apart pretty easily. That was an impressive performance, and in some ways, for right now, a career defining performance for Jake Shields, and I'm really curious to see what he does next. But this is I can't stress this enough how good this was for Strikeforce, especially after the last show. You know, when you have like Frank Shamrock losing, who was a, you know, cornerstone of their promotion, and some of those matchups like the Cyborg Okano fight, just not that good. You know, the Smith Raddick fight was a great fight, but you know, it Smith won, but he didn't look that good in the fight, I thought. And so, you know, he pulled another rabbit out of his hat. Here, like, all the winners look great, again, except for Mike Whitehead and a lot of guys that they could build in the future. I will say, though, like, while we're talking about Nick Diaz and Scott Smith, I mean, Scott Smith, I am very shocked at how much praise he gets. I mean, he puts out great fights and whatnot, but that second round performance, yes, you know, Diaz threw, I think it was 221 punches, but I mean, he wasn't moving his head. He wasn't doing anything. And for you to take so much damage and not give anything back, that is not good fighting. That's not smart fighting. And I'd like to see some people like start to criticize him a little bit more, because yeah, you could put on a great fight, but you know, anyone could like take a bunch of punches and then throw a couple punches and produce a great fight. That doesn't make you a good fighter. And I'd like to see him start to fight a little bit smarter in the future.
Yeah, and you know, he's really not that good a fighter. I mean, his whole reputation is built on being in some exciting fights. You know, twice on national television against Robbie Lawler. You know, I think would have lost the first time if it hadn't been, you know, a no contest, and then did lose the second time. He has that kind of once in a lifetime amazing knockout, you know, that got a lot of attention. I mean, he's known for exciting fights, but I don't think anyone considers him a top tier fighter. And I think the one guy that Strikeforce really has, maybe the only guy Strikeforce has, who I think you really look at and you say, this is a top level, you know, top five in his weight class fighter, is Jake Shields. He's really the only one who I think under the Strikeforce banner is at that level where you could see him taking on the best in the world in his weight class. I don't think he would beat GSP, but you could at least see him giving GSP even a run for his money. He's the only one. I don't think there's anyone else that Strikeforce has who you could say, you know, look at the number one fighter in the world in that weight class, could whoever the best in Strikeforce is compete. I think he's the only one. But, you know, if you look at Shields, Ariel, he is now on a 12-fight winning streak. And he's got some pretty impressive names, not just Robbie Lawler. I mean, Yushin Okami is one of the guys he's beaten. Carlos Condit is one of the guys he's beaten. A couple of the guys who are getting a lot of attention in Bellator these days, Toby Yamada and Dave Manet, are two of the guys he's beaten in that 12-fight winning streak. You know, Jake Shields, he's been winning consistently for quite a while now, and no, he hasn't beaten the top 10 UFC welterweights, but he has beaten a lot of names that average fans have probably at least heard of, which is an accomplishment when you're not fighting in the UFC.
Oh, it's a total accomplishment, and I mean, he doesn't just beat his opponents; he beats them rather convincingly, and I consider him top five. I guess at this point, you know, you can make a very strong case for him being maybe number two or number three behind either John Fitch or Thiago Alves. I mean, you definitely have to. Sorry?
I think, right. I think, you know, he's certainly behind GSP. I would probably put him behind both Fitch and Alves, and then I would probably have Shields number four. But you're right that he beats people convincingly. I mean, the last time he went the distance actually was his win over Carlos Condit, who's no slouch. And, you know, that's an impressive win to have on your resume. And that was more than 3 years ago now, and he's been fighting regularly and winning convincingly, usually wins in the first round, and when not in the first, in the second. So, you know, he's a force in the welterweight division, at least I think in the welterweight division. The guy he called out afterward was Kung Lee. I don't think we're going to see him again, but I am curious to get your thoughts. They've got this fight coming up, this fight card in August coming up that's going to be in San Jose. All these guys that Strikeforce has under contract who are from Northern California, Jake Shields, Nick Diaz, Frank Shamrock, Kung Lee, are we going to see any of those guys in that August card? Because to me, that would be rather foolish to have a show in San Jose and not put any of those guys on it.
Well, I mean, you do have Josh Thompson and Gilbert Melendez on the card, who are, you know, huge draws. I went to their fight last June that did very well. I think there was like 11,000 or 12,000 people at the HP Pavilion. So, and those are like two lightweight fighters. So that's a pretty impressive feat for Strikeforce. And I think of those guys, the one that has the best chance of being on the card would probably be Jake Shields, just because it wasn't, you know, that grueling of a fight. The thing is with Strikeforce that I think we need to sort of recognize every time we talk about them is that they're very different than the UFC. Their model is very different than the UFC. And in the UFC, you have this roster, and you can kind of look at it and say, okay, these guys are the contenders, and these guys are, you know, below contenders and are moving up, et cetera, et cetera. And here in Strikeforce, we have situations where I think it's going to be a little bit closer to boxing in some ways, where they'll pick up a guy for one fight. If he does well, they'll bring him back, like Andrei Arlovsky, perhaps like Mike Whitehead, like Kevin Randleman. We don't really know the terms of their contract. So it's hard to sort of look into the crystal ball when you're talking about Strikeforce and say, you know, I think this guy's going to fight this guy, and then next maybe he'll fight this guy. Because there's a lot of like potential free agents out there. You see their relationship with Affliction, which was, you know, highly publicized on the show. We know that they have a relationship with the Japanese promotion, so it's kind of hard to look and see because they have a lot of options out there. It's just a matter of who they bring in. I think that's pretty exciting because it's a little different. Obviously, we like to know who's in line for the shot, but that's why I wouldn't be shocked to see them pick up guys like Mayhem Miller. And I think the guy that they really need to pick up, if there's one guy out there that could really help Strikeforce, I say it again, Bobby Lashley would be a huge pickup for them just because he's such a big name. And on top of that, kudos to Strikeforce while we're, you know, praising them here, at least I am. Signing Gina Carano, they finally did it. I was surprised that Gina wasn't even in attendance, and they kind of, you know, flew that one under the radar and pumped up the Fyodor against Barnett fight. But kudos to them for doing it, because that's really a fight that can help them grow even more.
Yeah, you're definitely right about that. That's a huge fight, by far the biggest fight in women's MMA history. I mean, it almost goes without saying, but I mean, it's there's not even a number two. I mean, that is the fight in women's MMA. Great for Strikeforce that they got that fight. I agree with you. I was really struck watching the Showtime broadcast by how much they were promoting the Affliction August 1st show between Fedor Emelianenko and Josh Barnett, the main event. I did think it was rather silly that Gus Johnson, after Brett Rogers beat Andrei Arlovsky, immediately has to say, "Look out, Fedor." You know, I think that's a bit of an insult to our intelligence to suggest that Brett Rogers is someone who's going to make Fedor look out. I think Fedor is in a whole different stratosphere from Brett Rogers. But, certainly it is exciting to see Affliction and Strikeforce seeming willing to work together. I would hope, and also M1 Global working together with them, I would hope that means that down the road we could see Fedor and Barnett, you know, whoever wins that, I think Fedor taking on, you know, an Alistair Overeem, or maybe even at some point a Brett Rogers. He's not ready for Fedor yet, but, I think that's exciting that they were doing that much promoting of the Affliction show, but I agree with you that it was surprising that they weren't also interviewing Gina Carano live on the scene. I'm not quite sure why she wasn't there, but it's great that she'll be there for their August 15th show for the biggest women's fight ever.
You know, there's two things I just want to comment on that you just said. First off, I'm very disappointed in Gus Johnson as an MMA broadcaster. I'm a huge Gus Johnson fan. Anytime he's calling a basketball game or football game, I'm just a lot more excited about it. And he always, I always enjoy his call on the shows. And in his, you know, in his Elite XC tenure and now with Strikeforce, first off, his post-fight interviews, I find them to be very underwhelming. No intensity, and that's like the thing that I always loved about him, that he, you know, always get up for everything. I find his post-fight interviews to be very strange. And then the calls are just so forced, and like you said, like almost insulting our intelligence by saying that a guy like Brett Rogers could hang with Fyodor now. It's very weird.
Ariel, he wouldn't end a great college basketball game by saying, "Hey, North Carolina, they look so great, they could play the Lakers next." You know, he wouldn't do that because we all know that that's utterly ridiculous. So why he feels the need to do that in MMA, why can't he just say, wow, great showing by Brett Rogers, by far the best showing of his career against the toughest opponent of his career. Why he feels the need to take it then to that next level, take it to a ridiculous level, I just can't understand that, so I agree with you on that point.
Yeah, and you know, I think Frank Shamrock did a great job on the broadcast. I think Mauro Ranallo continues to do a great job. I know a lot of people don't like him, but he knows his MMA, and you can't deny that. And it's kind of weird to still see him in that third man role. But I would not be upset if Mauro Ranallo was doing the play by play. I've been very disappointed with Gus Johnson as of late. The other thing I wanted to mention was you know, how surreal it was to see Barnett and Fyodor on an Affliction Showtime broadcast, and we know that. You know, Showtime produces those Affliction pay-per-views, so that's the reason why they're there. And of course, you know, you saw Affliction all over the cage, and I'm sure there was some sort of deal in place when they got Arlovsky on the card. But it was still very weird, and it kind of like I don't know. It just like it made Fyodor look very real. You know what I mean? Like it was the first time that we got to see him on like a network broadcast in the United States, and it was like, wow, like this guy. It almost felt like he was like. It's kind of hard to explain. I guess the best way I could do it is just say that it was a little surreal for me to actually see him there and Barnett and hyping that fight, and it got me really excited for the fight. But I do agree, it was very strange to see them pump that one a little more than all their other fights. I thought they did a good job of pumping up Melendez and Thompson to get people into that fight. And overall, once again, I must say that I'm very impressed with the Showtime broadcast. You know, Gus Johnson's performance aside, I think their pre-fight packages are way better than the UFC's right now, and Zuffa's for that matter. I think that, you know, I don't mind. I mean, I think that their little, like, their little thing with the two guys and the keys to win is a little bit contrived. I mean, like, saying that a guy needs to, like, win via jab or, like, submission, I mean, it's kind of obvious what they're saying, but still different, cool. I like their camera angles. I like it really everything about them. And I think they're doing a great job in this sort of, you know, Ken Hirschman, the VP of Showtime Sports, said that, you know, this was like kind of version 2 of MMA on Strikeforce. And I think they're doing a tremendous job here in their second chance. And I really, really am enjoying their broadcast.
Yeah, I am too. And, you know, I think overall a good show. With Strikeforce, you're never totally sure what you're going to see next, but it was a good show, and I think August 15th is probably going to be a pretty good show, too. And now let's talk about what I thought was a great show. You were there live. I was watching on Versus WEC 41. I thought one of the best fights I've seen this year was Mike Brown defending his title against Uriah Faber. How impressed were you with what Mike Brown did?
Very impressed with what Mike Brown did, and really very impressed with what Uriah Faber was able to do too, with that broken right hand. I guess, I mean, now I'm hearing that he broke it in the first round. I'm looking forward to watching it. I haven't had a chance to watch it on television, but the fact that he was, you know, able to, you know, at least go for submissions in the fifth with a broken right hand is pretty damn impressive, and it appears as though he also dislocated his left hand. So he was really fighting with very few weapons. But Mike Brown, I mean, his performance, I hope that he's going to start to get the respect that he deserves from MMA fans and the MMA media. And I am so impressed with Mike Brown, you know, in the post-fight press conference, talking about how his feelings were even a little hurt by some of the things that the crowd was saying to him as he was walking to the cage and calling him a gay slur and flipping him the bird and all that stuff. And this guy is so real, and he's so humble, and he's just, you know, he's this MMA veteran who, you know, was fighting for very, very little dollars for so many years. And, you know, you can make a case that he's still fighting for very little dollars, but still, I mean, he's getting a lot of recognition now, and he is the man at 145. And I love being around him. I love covering him. I love watching him fight. And I tip my cap to him. That was another impressive performance and another great show by the WEC. Back-to-back, five-round epic title fights. Last time we saw Torres Mitsugaki, this time Brown Faber. They continue to wow us with a very thin roster, really. I always enjoy watching their cards.
Yeah, I thought it was a really tremendous showing by both fighters. You know, Uriah Faber, he deserves so much credit for the way I was watching on television, and it was after the third round that the Versus microphones picked up Faber telling his corner, look, I broke my hand. You know, at one point, someone in his corner said something like, you know, hook, go to the hook, use your hook. And he was like, I broke my hand, and, you know, but he wasn't saying it like, oh, I can't fight anymore, and I broke my hand. He was just kind of matter-of-factly saying, that's why I'm throwing all these elbows, because I can't use my hand. I can't punch. And I think that's extraordinary. And also, you could hear, watching on TV, Mike Brown's corner telling him, Faber obviously has a broken hand. We can see it. You probably can't see it in the middle of everything, but we can see the way he's favoring his hands. He obviously has hurt both of his hands. So it was really remarkable that Faber kept fighting and fighting pretty well. I personally, on my scorecard, I gave Faber the first round and Brown all the rest. So certainly it's not like Faber was great with the broken hands, but you know, the first round when his hands were okay, I had him winning that round. So you have to give Faber a lot of credit. These are the two best 145 pounders in the world, but Brown clearly deserves to be considered the number 145 pounder. I think some people after that first fight weren't totally convinced. Now you have to be convinced between what Brown did in the first fight, what he did to Leonard Garcia, now winning a fairly decisive unanimous decision in the rematch with Uriah Faber. It's really exciting to think of what he can do next. I think there are several other good featherweights who can give Mike Brown a tough test. I think next is going to be Jose Aldo, and I think that's, I don't think Jose Aldo is as good as Uriah Faber, but I think Jose Aldo has an interesting style that might force Mike Brown to do some things a little bit differently. But overall, it's just exciting to me to think about all the different fights that the WEC can put together for Mike Brown, because I think there are other good featherweights in the division. I think there's a pretty good chance we will see a third fight between them, although I think Faber really needs to earn that third fight. He can't just get handed that third fight. But what do you think? Will we see Brown versus Faber 3?
Perhaps at some point in the future. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. You know, some people could say that, well, you know, he broke his hand and it wasn't 100% Uriah Faber out there. Well, that's really part of the fight game. And, you know, you break your hand in a fight and you have to deal with it. So I think Mike Brown won that fight fair and square. And now I think the obvious matchup is him against Jose Aldo. And I'm really enjoying watching Jose Aldo's meteoric rise up the 145-pound middleweight division. Excuse me, middleweight division. I was featherweight division. The reason I say middleweight is because I was just about to say that, you know, dare I say it's very reminiscent of a guy by the name of Anderson Silva when he came to the UFC and just annihilated everyone en route to his title shot, and he still holds that title. You know, defeating Cub Swanson in 8 seconds and opening up that insane cut over his left eye, over his right left eyebrow, this guy is deadly, and I love watching his post-fight celebrations. I don't know if they caught it on television. This time, he didn't try to run into the crowd, but was just like bouncing off the cage, and even Reed Harris, like a parent, the WEC general manager, had to like go and calm him down, like seriously say, like, just chill out for a second, you're going nuts here. He just has a, you know, at the post-fight press conference, very infectious smile and very charismatic, and I'm really excited to see Brown against Aldo. I think they've done a great job in building up Aldo, obviously a great job in building up Brown, and this is really, when you take a step back and look at WEC, you know, when they first came on Versus, it was all about, like, you know, Uriah Faber against some contender, just kind of fights that were, like, thrown together, and now with, like, Miguel Torres and Brian Bowles and Brown against Aldo, and then, you know, like, if Joseph Benavidez beats Dominic Cruz, you think that he'll have to fight the champion. They're really building up contenders, and you can kind of step back and see the way things shake out in WEC, when a year ago, I don't think you could say that. It was just kind of random matchups. And it's very exciting. They've done credit to Sean Shelby, the WEC matchmaker. He's done a great job in building up the contenders. And, they don't have as deep of a roster as UFC. They'll never be the UFC just because, you know, they don't have all those, you know, premier weight classes. But they've done a nice job in creating a niche for themselves in a sort of corner of the MMA marketplace that a lot of people thought couldn't be successful with having just lightweight fighters. So my hat's off to WEC after another great show.
Yeah, you mentioned where they were a year ago. It was actually exactly a year ago. It was the first Sunday of June in 2008 that they had what at the time was by far their biggest card, and that was when Uriah Faber fought Jens Pulver, who I want to talk about in a minute. But I think you can really see, I don't know yet, I haven't seen the ratings on Versus. I don't know if this card got the TV audience that one did, which at the time was by far WEC's biggest rating on Versus. But I do know that you can see how WEC has grown since then, because at the time of that card, which was Uriah Faber, Jens Pulver, and it was Miguel Torres against Yoshiro Maeda, at that time I thought, boy, these were a couple of great title fights we saw with Faber and Torres, but what else does the WEC really have? And that's not what I'm thinking now. Now I'm thinking, I'm looking forward to Brown against Aldo. I'm looking forward to seeing when and where and against whom Uriah Faber fights next. I'm looking forward to seeing Miguel Torres against Brian Bowles. I'm looking forward to seeing guys like Jeff Curran and Takeya Mizugaki. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with the flyweight division. And all of these things that now you feel like the WEC, it put on a big show. And there's going to be more big shows to come. And I think that's where they've reached that level of kind of maturity as an organization where you can feel like they are here to stay.
And you know what's interesting, if we take another step back here and look at like the entire MMA landscape, is I was very concerned like maybe less than a year ago when the IFL went under, Affliction appeared to be on the ropes, and they in many ways could still be on the ropes, Elite XC going under, and you were like, wow, you know, this is... You know, at one point there were so many MMA organizations out there. Even Bodog Fight was, you know, throwing around a lot of money, and it was a kind of a depressing time to be an MMA fan. And now here we are in June. Strikeforce is as healthy as ever, and they look to be, you know, they're a major player, whether you know everyone likes it or not. WEC continues to sort of defy the odds here and become successful with just featuring lightweight fighters, and UFC with all their great fights coming up. Later on this summer, still as strong as ever, and even Sengoku picking up some very interesting fighters as of late. So you know, the MMA landscape after all these you know organizations died, and even Pride, you could go back to you know when Pride went down a couple of years ago, is now maybe as healthy as ever, and there's a lot of great stars coming up that aren't under the Zuffa banner, and that's very exciting as well. That it's not just you know. Zuffa and the sort of minor leagues. There's a lot of great fights going on outside of Zuffa, and I think that you have to give a lot of credit to Affliction, who's been doing a lot of press, and I don't know if they did it on purpose last week to try to steal the thunder. I think we might be giving them too much credit if we say that, but they did steal a little bit of the headlines you know, last week with doing their press tour in New York and LA to announce their next show, and I think they've got some great fights on that card too. I'm just excited now for MMA, because for a while it looked very bleak, and now you have all these other promotions putting on great fights and fights that make sense and fights that we could, you know, this is something that boxing doesn't have. When a fight ends, you don't know who's going to fight who. I mean, you have like, oh, you know, is Pacquiao going to fight Mosley? Is Pacquiao going to, you know, wait for the winner of Mayweather-Marquez? Can they make the deal happen? I mean, there's a lot of problems in boxing like that. MMA doesn't seem to have that problem. That's really exciting.
Yeah, and the one other thing I want to talk about from the WEC card is Jens Pulver. He lost to Josh Crispy. There's no way to sugarcoat it. I mean, he just kind of walked right into a guillotine choke. He lasted all 33 seconds against Josh Crispy. Real disappointing. Did we see Jens Pulver for the last time? Do you think we might see him again, or now that he's lost six of his last seven fights, is it time for us to just say Jens Pulver is done in MMA?
Well, I hope he's done in MMA, but I don't think we have seen him for the last time. I think we may have seen him for the last time in a WEC cage, but you know, he was on the post-fight show, ESPN Radio 1100, with Steve Cofield and I, and he was like, you know what, I don't make six figures every year. He made $30,000 or $31,000 for this fight. He lives in a small house in Iowa. The guy is in his mid-30s, and he's not economically stable right now. So I think he needs to fight. And, you know, that's just the reality of the situation. I hope he doesn't fight. I think Jens Pulver 5 years ago would have never got caught in that guillotine choke. It's just one of those situations where I think he still thinks he can fight. He says he looks good in practice, and he said if he'd be getting knocked out in all these fights, he'd say, okay, it's time for me to go, but he's getting caught. And I think to that I would respond, it's almost the same thing because your reaction time is just slower. So yes, it doesn't look as bad if you're not getting knocked out, but you're still getting choked out pretty quickly by, you know, guys who are, you know, 10 to 15 years younger than you. It should be time to hang up, you know, hang up those gloves. I hope, you know, I think he would be great to be on the WC on Versus telecast. I think it makes a lot more sense in having him rather than Frank Mir call those fights, just because he's a lighter fighter. He's fought with some of these guys. He is sort of the WEC right now, kind of one of the more recognizable characters in the WC. So I think that would make a lot more sense. But how much money can he truly make off of that? He's in a situation much like Chuck Liddell, and younger than Chuck Liddell, actually. And he's actually the same age as Mike Brown, which is amazing to think.
Yeah, it is amazing. And that really gets to just the whole thing. It's not so much your age as it's how the individual athlete is responding to the age, because it's remarkable to think that, you know, Mike Brown, you look at, he's been around a long time, but he still looks like he's getting better from fight to fight, whereas Jens Pulver has been around for a long time, and he is just much worse than he used to be.
The thing I want to mention is, you know, Josh Grisby, I was very impressed with him. I mean, this guy's a kid, 20 years old. You know, a lot of people didn't know a lot about him. I mean, he's been doing great in WEC in his MMA career, but the way he reacted to that loss was fascinating. I mean, he was so he didn't know how to react. When Pulver was lying on top of him after the choke, he didn't even like celebrate. He didn't scream afterwards. I was watching him, you know, stand on the side of the cage, and I even asked him this question in the post-fight press conference, and he agreed with me. He felt very uncomfortable with the fact that he might have just ended Jens Pulver's career. And Jens kept telling him at the press conference, you know, like, I would have done, I was trying to drop you on your head. I was trying to kill you out there. Don't feel bad. It's not you. You know, you should feel very proud of what you did. And he just was very shy in the post-fight press conference. They were sitting next to each other. Jens put his arm around him at one point. Like, he felt really bad about beating Jens Pulver. And, you know, I give him a lot of credit for that. I think he's going to be a big star, and I think he would be, after one more victory, next in line to face the winner of Aldo Brown. But I was just really impressed with watching that. I don't know if that came across on television, but I thought it was very sweet to see.
Okay. He came across exactly the right way. He said on the interview that was broadcast on Versus, you know, I would boo me if I were fighting Jens Pulver, too. He said all the right things. And he seems like just a great young man. I mean, he's 20 years old, seems very mature. But I don't want to portray him as such a nice guy that we forget. He's destroying his opponents. He's had three WEC fights so far. He beat Mark Hominick in 255 of the first round. He beat Micah Miller in 50 seconds of the first round. And now he's beaten Jens Pulver in 33 seconds of the first round. 3-0 in the WEC. Combined total of less than 5 minutes in the cage to build up that 3-0 record. He's really just running through his opposition right now. If he's 20 years old, he's going to keep getting better. And I think it's really exciting to think about. You've got the older guy, Mike Brown, who's the champion now, but Josh Grisby is 20. I believe Jose Aldo's 22. I mean, that's exciting for the future of the featherweight division.
Yeah, and on the undercard, they had a lot of young fighters that looked very good. So they've got a nice little thing going on with the bantamweights and the featherweights, at least. I want to ask you about the lightweight division, because that's, you know, it's obviously the forgotten division in WEC. And it's weird because Donald Cerrone, you know, looked very impressive against James Krause. He should have beaten James Krause. He said that, you know, his camp was a little bit scared for him to take this fight because it was really a lose-lose situation, since he did seem to have that rematch against Jamie Varner locked up. The two things I want to say about the lightweight division in WEC are, first off, I don't see why. I mean, I guess I see why Donald Cerrone gets the shot. They've been doing a lot of trash talking. The fight ended a little bit inconclusively, but I thought that he was losing every round of that fight, and I don't really see why he warrants getting another shot at Jamie Varner. But it is, you know, because it's such a thin division, it's the only fight that makes sense. It's the only fight that can actually main event a card. The other thing is that, like, I don't understand really. I mean, they don't seem to be featuring it as much as the other two divisions, and I was very interested to hear Cerrone say, actually, on the ESPN radio post-fight show, that if he gets the WEC lightweight title, that's not, you know, his end goal. That's just a stepping stone for him. And you don't hear a lot of guys talk like that who are part of WEC. He doesn't think Jamie Varner is a top 15 lightweight. He doesn't think that he's obviously smart to say this, but I'm surprised that he did. He doesn't think that the WEC lightweight division is, you know, all that good compared to the UFC's lightweight division, that he's absolutely correct. But it was just interesting to hear him speak so openly about it. And he was saying that, you know, I want to get into the UFC right away. I want to win a couple more fights here, and I'm looking to get into the UFC. And that's a problem when you have your WEC lightweight fighters talk like that, because that really, you know, devalues that division. And they really need to get that flyweight division going, and maybe even a women's division, because the lightweight division is getting ignored. And when you have your top stars talking like that, it's hard for the fans to take it serious.
Yeah, that's certainly correct. And you know, the bottom line is these lightweight fights in the WEC are always going to come across as second tier. I mean, as long as the WEC and the UFC are sharing any weight classes, we know that as soon as someone is good enough, he's going to be brought into the UFC. So, you know, if some lightweight in the WEC, I don't think it's going to be either Cerrone or Varner, but if some lightweight in the WEC it looks young and really impressive and really sharp, we all know it's just going to be a matter of time before they put him into the UFC where they can really fight the best. And so, yeah, I don't really see why there is a lightweight division in the WEC other than they want to have enough different weight classes to have a little bit of diversity, for lack of a better word. It's just not all that interesting to see lightweight fights in the WEC when we all know that the better lightweights are in the UFC. So, yeah, I think Cerrone versus Varner 2 will be a fine fight. I'll watch it, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it. But it won't be an elite-level fight like a fight that involves a Mike Brown or a Miguel Torres is an elite-level fight. And I do think that's a problem for the WEC.
I will say this, though. Those two guys really hate each other. You could tell, even in the post-fight press conference, Cerrone talking about Jamie Varner, they really hate each other. And that, you know, I guess that's always fun, right? I mean, when there's a grudge match and there's some heat in the fight, then it's easy to get up for it. But then afterwards, it's like we're talking about, you know, who's next in line for the featherweight and bantamweight title. I mean, I can't even think off the top of my head who would be next in line for that title after Varner and Cerrone. So that's the only little issue right now that I have with WEC. But other than that, doing a great job. And I think it's good that they're not putting on too many shows. I definitely don't think that they're ready for pay-per-view. But, you know, if they put on like 6 or 7 shows a year, once every 2 months or so, that's fine. You know, you could get a lot of great shows. You could get a lot of great shows, a lot of great fights together. And I should mention, for the people that weren't there, there were like a little over 12,000 people inside the Arco Arena. The crowd, when Uriah Faber came out, when California Love was playing on the speakers, that felt like any UFC show that I've ever been to. It felt like GSP coming out in the Bell Center in Montreal. And that wasn't a UFC event. So the WEC is very much alive, just by looking at the reaction that they got in the Arco Arena. And Reed Harris said they'd like to go there at least once a year, and I think they'd be pretty smart to do so, because that's two straight shows that have done very well at the Arco Arena.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very good show. And I think we can now talk about a very interesting show that is coming up this coming Saturday, UFC 99. I think it's a really interesting card, because to me, when I look at it, I don't see one fight that looks to me like a can't-miss great fight, but I see 6 fights, all of which are going to make the live pay-per-view card, that I think are very good fights, and you rarely get 6 live fights on any card, but you especially, you basically never get 6 really good live fights on one pay-per-view card. What do you think of this card top to bottom, Ariel?
I don't want to sound like a fanboy right now, but I feel so blessed to be an MMA fan, to be someone who covers the sport. This card is a perfect example. I love this card. Those 6 fights, I would watch any one of those. Those could be like main events of fight nights. You know what I mean? They're not your typical, you know, like Franklin Vanderlei Silva is not your typical UFC event. I think we're very spoiled in the sense that there's a lot of title fights as of late, but this is an amazing card. Every single one of the fights on the card makes sense. And one fight in particular that I'm really excited for that is getting zero attention online is the Kyle Uno-Spencer Fisher fight. I'm so excited to see Kyle Uno finally back in the UFC. I've been a big fan of his for a long time. Very excited about that. Dan Hardy and Marcus Davis, you know, you were there on the conference call last week. They've been doing a tremendous job in building up that fight. And even a fight like Mike Swick and Ben Saunders, another one that's sort of flying under the radar, makes a lot of sense. And Ben Saunders has flown under the radar as of late. He's been doing very well in the UFC. And, of course, Cain Velasquez, always happy to see him back. And I think this fight against Chet Congo makes a lot more sense than Heath Herring. I know I kind of ran through the card here very quickly, but all this to say that very excited about it. And I'm also really curious to see how the fans in Germany react, because we know about the negative press that the UFC has received over there. I think everyone in attendance is going to be very positive, but it's another fun European card, and I think this one is going to be sort of like UFC 95, where a lot of people were kind of doubting it. I think this one's a lot better than UFC 95, and afterwards, like UFC 95, I think it's going to be very well received. I'm expecting some really good fights and some good finishes too.
Yeah, you know, I went into UFC 95 thinking it was not a very good card, and came out of it thinking it was it had been a terrific card. This one I'm going into thinking it's going to be great. I mean, I really do. Once again, you know, you look at these six fights and you're just excited about all of them. All six of them, there's just like a natural storyline to them, and you know, you can see how with all of them, you can see how stylistically they have the potential to just be really exciting fights. I just think it's great. I think they just did a phenomenal job of matchmaking, and I love the fact that they're putting six fights on the pay-per-view card live. I think it'll be a huge ovation from the crowd there in Germany. There are two German fighters on the non-televised portion of the show, and I'm sure they'll get huge ovations. But I also think, you know, with Mirko Krokop, I think there's going to be quite a bit of excitement for him. You know, even guys, a lot of people kind of forget. I mean, Chet Congo, he lives like a four-hour drive from Cologne, Germany, where he lives in France. So, you know, that's really close. I would bet there will be a pretty good fan base there for him. I think that it's just a terrific card. I'm really excited about it. And I also, by the way, I like the fact that we get to watch this one live Saturday afternoon. I much prefer that. I know certainly pay-per-view costs make that difficult for some fans, but I much prefer that to watching on tape.
I'll go out on a limb here and say that I think that Mirko Krokop's second run in the UFC is going to go almost exactly like his first run. I don't know if he's going to get knocked out, but I expect him to win this fight, and then I expect him to lose his next two and then be out. I don't know. I haven't really been impressed with him all that much since leaving the UFC, and I just think it's a different ball game from the one that he's used to in Japan. So I actually expect it to go, you know, the script will go the same way as it did the first time round. The finishes might be different, but I'm not expecting him to have a good run in the UFC. How about you?
No, I'm not either. I am expecting him to win this fight. I'm not totally sure how long he's going to stick around in the UFC this second time around. I do expect him to win this one. I think after this one, I don't know who they would match him up with. You know, I could see it maybe being someone like the Congo Velasquez winner, which I suppose could be kind of an interesting fight because, of course, it was Chet Congo who kind of sent Mirko Krokop packing from the UFC last time around. That maybe they would do that as a rematch. I would pick Chet Congo again. You know, I don't know how they'll match up Mirko Krokop, because I think he's one of those guys, and you see it with all pro athletes who stick around long enough, who his fame lasts longer than his skill set does. And, you know, he's certainly on the downside of his career. He's not the great fighter he once was, but I'm still excited about seeing him. I'm still excited about his fight with Mustafa Al-Turk, and I think he will win that fight. But yeah, I do agree with you, Ariel, that he probably is not going to have a real successful second run in the UFC.
Well, let's talk about the main event, because I think it's obviously an interesting matchup, and it's called the comeback, really, because you know, Rich Franklin is coming off of a loss, and you know that was a bit of an uninspired performance against Dan Henderson. I think in the back of his mind, when they fought in January at UFC 93, he really didn't want to be a coach on The Ultimate Fighter, and obviously I don't know if this, you know, played a role in his performance, but I wouldn't be surprised to hear him say that it did. And then you have Wanderlei Silva, who's had, you know, a strange run in the UFC, and it is obviously not the same axe murderer that we once knew. Only has one loss since coming back to the UFC. That was a vicious knockout of Keith Jardine at UFC 84. But other than that, you know,
only has one win back.
Excuse me. Yeah, I was thinking about the two losses. Quinton Jackson and Chuck Liddell were the two losses. The one win, of course, against Keith Jardine. He needs this victory very badly. If he loses,
Silva. I mean, if you look back, since that vicious knockout loss to Mirko Krokop, that was really the beginning of the end for Wanderlei Silva. And, you know, although he's still fun to watch, since then he's lost to Dan Anderson, lost to Liddell, lost to Rampage, only beaten Keith Jardine.
It's almost like Jens Pulver, you know, what's going on with him. And he's not losing as devastatingly as Paul. A submission is equally devastating, but I mean, he's getting knocked out sometimes, you know, like the Quinn Jackson knockout was pretty bad. So he needs this win. And I think that if he loses, I know Dana is a huge fan of his, but if he loses, it might be hard to bring him back, depending on the way that he loses. And Rich Franklin is in this very interesting spot in his career right now because, you know, obviously there's nothing doing for him at 185. This fight is at a catchweight 195. I think that he would be better served fighting at 205. There's a lot of fresh matchups for him there. So he also needs a big victory here. At the end of the day, I'm picking Franklin. I think he's a better fighter right now. I think he's still an underrated fighter. And I think he's hungry for the victory and is just better, you know, more well-rounded right now than Wanderlei Silva. Silva just comes out there, guns blazing, and gets caught as of late. So I'm expecting Franklin to pick up the victory. Second round, TKO.
I'm actually picking Wanderlei Silva in this one. I think Wanderlei Silva will beat Rich Franklin. I think Wanderlei Silva, 195 pounds, is a better weight for him. I think Wanderlei Silva is going to beat Rich Franklin, and I'm excited to see him at 185, which will be where he fights next. Assuming he wins, which I agree isn't a safe assumption, but I think he will. I think Wanderlei Silva better off at a lighter weight, and I think he's going to look good against Rich Franklin. Either way, it's a fight I'm excited about. I think it's going to be an excellent fight. I'm excited about seeing both of these guys, even though neither one of them is in a title picture right now. I think they're both still guys that I want to see.
What about Czech Congo Cain Velasquez? This is a must-win situation, I think, for Velasquez, just because, obviously he's not in danger of getting cut from the UFC. I mean, he's doing tremendously, but there's been a lot of buzz about him, and he hasn't fought the best of the best, and kind of like, you know, Shane Carwin when he fought Gabriel Gonzaga, although I think Congo's a better fighter than Gonzaga. We were interested to see how Carwin would fight against top-tier talent, and he fought, tremendously, knocking Gonzaga out. So now I'm interested to see Velasquez and how he fights against Congo, because those two guys have been, you know, sort of paralleling each other in their rise up the UFC heavyweight ranks. Obviously, Carwin has a few more fights under his belt, but sort of a similar rise. And I'm curious to see how Velasquez performs. And I think Congo's another guy that's very underrated. It's a tough one to call, but I'm going to pick an upset here. And I think it would be an upset. I think that Cain Velasquez is going to beat Czech Congo via decision, split decision, three-round fight. But he's got his work cut out for him because Congo is very good on his feet, obviously. His ground game is a little suspect, and I think that that's where Cain Velasquez will be a little bit better than him come Saturday.
You know, I'm picking Czech Congo in that one, and I think that it's a really good fight, and I think that the winner is real close to title contention. Probably wouldn't go directly against the winner of Mir Lesnar, probably has to win one more fight after that. But I think it's a big heavyweight fight. It's one of many big heavyweight fights we're going to see this summer. And I think right now, Czech Congo is just a little bit more complete of a mixed martial artist. I still think Cain Velasquez has some things he needs to work on. I was not real impressed with Cain Velasquez's most recent win on that UFC fight night in February. I thought he looked a little tentative, a little bit slow in his stand-up, and I think Czech Congo is going to beat him.
It's going to be a good fight, and that's really, you know, Cain Velasquez, like you said, his stand-up skills have been, a little bit questioned that it wasn't that of a great performance in February. I wasn't as down on his performance as some other people, but I definitely think that his I mean, Kong, we've seen, you know, when Kongo fought a guy like Keith Haring, how bad his ground game was. And I think that Cain Velasquez, in this limited time that he's known about this fight, is going to prepare for that and look to exploit it on Saturday. And I don't know if Velasquez has improved. I know he's been fighting with, you know, better ground fighters, you know, at the Wolf Slayer Academy. But I just don't know if he's going to be able to, you know, to hang with Velasquez. Velasquez is a big boy for a heavyweight. They're both similar weights, but he's just very, like, you know, very compact. And I think he'll be able to impose as well on the ground. The other fight that I want to get your prediction on is the Hardy-Davis fight. And what does this mean for the welterweight division? They've been doing a lot of, you know, they've been doing a lot of trash talking. But do you think that, like, the guy who wins this fight is actually a major player at 170? Or is this just kind of one of those kind of, not really gatekeeper type fights, but middle tier fights that really in the grand scheme of things doesn't mean much?
Yeah, I tend to think it's more sort of that middle tier fight. I don't see this as a, you know, as a huge fight that's really going to shape the direction of the welterweight division. I actually would argue that of the welterweights fighting on Saturday, Mike Swick is the one who has the best claim to, if he wins, being close to title contention. But this Marcus Davis-Dan Hardy fight, I think it's just become a lot of fun hearing these guys go back and forth. You and I both were in on a conference call where they really went at it. UFC has posted one of these videos where they're going back and forth. I think that makes it a lot of fun. I don't think that I wouldn't put either one of these guys in quite in that elite level of welterweights, but I do think that the winner has a fairly impressive win added to his resume, whoever wins this fight. And I just think it's going to be a fun fight. It's going to be a fight that the fans really get into. And, you know, that's what it's about. When it's not about guys who are close to title contention, I think it's great to see this type of matchmaking, matching up two guys who have some personal animosity. I think, you know, that doesn't always make for the greatest of fights as far as the MMA skill on display, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Yep, I think that Mike Swick is going to win that fight. I think he's a better fighter. I'm still a little bit, you know, I'm not sold on him being the number one contender after GSP and Alves, but, you know, we'll have to see what happens in that fight. But I still think that, you know, a win over Ben Saunders doesn't really put you in, you know, number one contender status right away. We've seen weirder things happen, of course. But other than that, I think it'll be a great fight. And they really have similar, you know, builds. You know, their body types are very similar, kind of these very lean, tall welterweights. So I think it'll be a great card. And another reason as to why it's so great to cover MMA, it just, like, never stops here with these great shows. And, you know, again, kudos to the UFC and their matchmaking for putting on these fights that we can get excited about, because they're really, it's just really one event after another where there are really no duds out there, none that we can really complain about. So it's another great one. Unfortunately, we have to pay for this one. We got spoiled this weekend with two free shows, which says a lot about, you know, where MMA is right now as well, but I'll gladly do so for this one.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think UFC 99 is going to be a terrific card. It was a great weekend behind us. It's a great weekend ahead of us. And Ariel, it is always great to talk about MMA with you. Thank you so much for joining me once again for our MMA podcast.